believe that this is a will construction case. I would like to read that part of the will first before I state any of the facts so that we can have that in our minds. This is the last will of Mattie Lou Moore, and she said in paragraph 2 of her will, I hereby give, devise, and bequeath all of my property, real, personal, and mixed, to my 6 children, Herman, Dewey, Ruby, Lester, Carl, and Cecil, and to the survivor or survivors of them at the time of my death, share and share alike in fee simple. This will is dated February 2 of 1954, and Mrs. Moore died on July 8 of 1976. She was of those 6 children, all of them were living at the time of her death, with the exception of Herman. Herman died in 1961. Herman had 2 children. One of those was Nadine White, and she is one of the petitioners herein. The other child was named Leon, and Leon died in 1952, which was before even the date that Mrs. Moore, his grandmother, made the will. Leon had 2 children. One of those, Dora Jean Cantrell, is the other petitioner in these proceedings, and Jimmy Leon Moore, the other, he has assigned all of his rights, whatever they might be, in Mrs. Moore's estate to the petitioners.
So Nadine is the aunt of Dora Jean?
Yes, sir. And of course, the respondents in this case are the other 5 children of Mrs. Moore, Dewey, Ruby, Lester, Carl, and Cecil. The petitioners filed this suit in Scurry County for an interpretation of the will and also for an accounting. The trial court severed the accounting features of the case, and then it proceeded with a summary judgment wherein the trial court found that the provisions of this will were such that neither Nadine nor Dora Jean were entitled to any part of the estate of Mrs. Moore because Herman had predeceased his mother. The Court of Appeals at Eastland agreed with that decision. We think that both courts are in error in the manner in which they have constructed this will. If you've noticed, when I read the portions of the will, I emphasize the word and that precedes to the survivor or survivors of them, and also I'd like to emphasize the words of them. Our position is that this is not a class gift, as the trial court opinion was, nor that of the Court of Appeals. Our opinion is that this will should be construed so as to say, in effect, that I give all of my property to Herman and to his survivors, to Dewey and to his survivors, and the same way with the other children, so that you make use of the words of them so that they mean something, rather than the position of the respondent and the courts below, that the word and should be read of. Our position is that the word and the word of are very dissimilar, and being conjunctive and or being disjunctive. And then I like to go to paragraph 3 of the will, that it may not mean a whole lot, but yet I think it means something. She appointed her 2 sons to serve as co-executors of her estate, directed that no bond or other security be required of them. And I notice she didn't say of either of them or any other words, but she used the same words of them to refer to the 2 sons, the same of them that I think should refer to the 5 children of them. She says of them in one place, and of them ought to be of them in another place. So I think that's what she really meant, that I'm going to give this estate of mine to my 6 children and to their survivors, if any of them are deceased. Now, I grant that she could have used more apt words. In fact, I don't believe the exact wording of this will has ever been construed by a court in this state. But if she had intended to, and use a common parlance, cut out a child, I think it would have been very easy for her to have done so by saying, and to such of them who may be living at the time of my death. But she didn't say that. She said, to the survivor or survivors of them. And we think the plain English construction and the plain legal construction should be that and in the conjunctive and of them in an ordinary sentence structure is going to refer to all of her children. The cases that we have cited in our application are not exactly in point, because as I've just said, we've been unable to find another case exactly construing words similar to this. The respondent has also stated that they have been unable to find an exact case in Texas on this issue. I think some of the language that's contained in this court's recent opinion of in that Henderson versus Parker case would help us look a little at this language and come to the same conclusion that the petitioners have. In that case, the court will recall that the testators said, we give, devise, and bequeath unto our surviving children of this marriage all of our property as follows. And then they named the 3 children and what particular tracts of land the 3 would get out of a 100-acre tract. And they all were going to be treated equally because one son had already been given a 5-acre tract. So they each got 33 and a third acres, counting the 5 acres that the son by the name of Donald had already received. In that case, the court will recall that the Court of Appeals in that case also stated that that was a class gift, similar to the analysis and reasoning of the Court of Appeals in this case, that it was a class gift. Our position, of course, is that it was not a class gift, that the naming of, the use of the words, our children, or my children, are very similar, because one will was by one person, and the other was a joint will in the Parker case. But other than that, they're saying practically the same thing. We give, devise, and bequeath unto our surviving children. Or I give, devise, and bequeath unto my 6 children. Or to the and to the survivor or survivors of them. And of course, this court disagreed with the appeals court in that Parker case and rendered judgments for all, dividing the property among all the 3 children.
Tell me again one more time why you say this is not a class gift.
Your Honor, I think it's not a class gift because she specifically names all 6 children. And I think the use of the words my 6 children is more of a general classification, and then there's the specific of the 6 that are named. Of course, there's the other case that we've cited, the Henshaw case. Somewhat similar, and yet not exactly similar either. In that case, the testatrix said the property was to be divided among the surviving sisters and brothers of myself and my husband. And then she says in the following manner. And then she went on to give half of her estate to her sister, and the remaining half to be divided among the surviving brothers and sisters of my husband. And I think the words there, the surviving brothers and sisters of my husband, is a little different than to the survivor or survivors of them, because the court will note in that case that the this court required that the siblings of the brother of the husband had to survive. And I think that's the difference in the two cases. In our case, under this will, there's no requirement that either or any of the children survive her in order for any of them to take. Because I think the use of the word "and" is the crux of the case. It's very crucial to it. And of course, the words "of them." I believe that that is all that I have to present to the court.
Let me ask you
a
couple of questions. Page 7 of your application, you seem to be saying that Section 68 of the Probate Code is not applicable, and therefore the cases cited in respect to that statute, the anti-lapse statute, as far as lineal descent, not in point. But then on page 11 of your application, you seem to be saying that the Section 68 is applicable. I wonder if you could clear that up for me, please.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand the anti-lap statute, when the testator devises property to a child that predeceases the testator, under that statute, the children of the deceased child, or the grandchildren, stands in the place of the father and inherits from the grandparent.
So you're taking the position then the anti-lapse statute is applicable?
I really am. I didn't realize in our brief it was could be construed to say that the anti-lapse statute wouldn't be involved in this case.
Did you, in the trial court, contend that the anti-lapse statute was applicable?
That it was applicable?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'm at a disadvantage because I was not in the trial court when the case was tried. My understanding was that we took the position that the statute was applicable.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Forrest Bowers will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I hope that it's not without the permissibility at this point in time to make a personal reference concerning the person that signed the brief for the petitioner. If it is improper, I ask you to forgive me. Galloway Huffaker was a friend of mine, and we buried him about 2 or 3 weeks ago in Tahoka, Texas, and I couldn't let the opportunity go by without acknowledging the loss of a man that I considered a great and good lawyer, and with the public statement that we'll miss him. Let me visit with you concerning what I believe to be the issues in this case. First, I believe that the Supreme Court needed to grant a writ. I have believed that from the moment we stood up in the trial court and each of us moved for summary judgment. It might be that we were both wrong in moving for summary judgment, in which event I believe this court has the inherent power to remand it for trial for further development. That is not to indicate any weakness of our position in this case. I think we're entitled to a summary judgment. It was granted and affirmed by the Court of Appeals in Eastland. Nevertheless, this is the first time this fact situation has ever been presented to any court in Texas, as far as I have been able to determine. In discussing this case, I think we have to talk about what Justice Ray, in writing for the court in Parker versus Henderson, had to say about the value of the words of survivorship. I think we must talk about what Justice Campbell had to say in Perry versus Henshaw in writing for the court. And I think we must revert back to Haygood case in 1916, which defines what is a class. And it's because of the Henshaw case addressing one particular fact situation, Parker versus Henderson addressing a little different fact situation, and Haygood and versus Haygood giving us what we should follow as a class definition, or what constitutes a class, and draw from each of those opinions that portion of those opinions that would be applicable here, and let the Supreme Court, this honorable court, write upon this fact situation. Then let me review with you what I think are the issues in this case. Number one, whether a testatrix or testator has the right to has a legal right to make a bequest to his or her lineal descendants. I'm talking about the anti-lap statute now. Lineal descendants, and make a class gift to them in the face of and notwithstanding the anti-lap statute. The reason I say that's one of the issues here is that I do not believe this court is prepared to say a testator, testatrix, does not have the right to do with his or her property what he or she wants to do with it, so long as it does not violate the rule against perpetuities, doctrine of worthy of title, rule in Shelley's case, which I never really fully understood in law school. In other words, so long as they make no alienation of the property that would take it out of the stream of commerce, that's about the best that I can do with it. But if they want to leave it to the five children, or six children, and nothing to the grandchildren, I suppose that we live in a land where they have the right to do that. Now, the anti-lap statute was urged by the petitioner at the trial of this case. I did not know for sure and certain whether they were urging the anti-lap statute applying here or not, because of some contrary statements made in the brief, and I labored over their position in that regard for some period of time. But that's number one issue. Can they do it if they want to? To me, that is the issue that we must address because of the language of survivors that was used in the case of Parker versus Henderson, authored by Justice Wright. Now let's go to the second issue. Whether Parker versus Henderson has such language and governing precedents that forecloses or indicates a trend to foreclose on the proposition I just stated. In other words, do we see a trend in Parker that says, no, we're not going to allow a testatrix to give to their children and bar the grandchildren if one predeceases her? That's what we must decide. I don't believe that's what Parker versus Henderson said. I do not believe Parker versus Henderson contradicts the result of the Court of Appeals in Eastland, and we'll talk about why in just a moment. I do not believe that the two are in conflict with one another, the Court of Appeals opinion in this case and your opinion in Parker versus Henderson. I don't think there's any conflict.
Mr. Bowers, while we're talking about the Court of Appeals, they took the position that the anti-lapse statute was not applicable. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you, I know you're happy with the, their decision, but do you agree with them on that point, that the anti-lapse statute is not applicable to this case?
The anti-lapse statute is not applicable. I'm not real happy with the language that the Court of Appeals used in that regard, with all due respect to the author and that Court of Appeals. The anti-lapse statute does not apply. We do not reach it. And the reason it doesn't is because of the magic words as used in Parker versus Henderson, word survivor. And the survivor is the magic language, because as was argued by Mr. Green in his argument to the court a moment ago, he says of them, he used the words of them, and the survivor of them. Survivor of whom? A class composed of the six brothers and sisters. That's the reason that the word survivor is so important. And we'll have occasion to talk about that again. I assume then that the issue number two, that this court is not going to say that a testatrix cannot give to her children, where if one dies, the rest of them takes that deceased child's part. There's no reason for such a rule of law. An anti-lapse statute was passed to prevent this sort of situation. I give to my six daughters and sons, period. Now then, the anti-lapse statute does apply in that instance if one of those children predeceased the testatrix. That's where the anti-lapse statute comes into play. I give to my son Herman, period. And then Herman predeceases the testatrix. Then, of course, Rule 68 of the probate code, the anti-lapse statute, would come in and say, then the children take that deceased child's part. And that is the law, and I'm happy with it. It's been the law for a long period of time. It's good law. But if there is a class carved and the testatrix says, I want it to go to these six children of mine, and if one of them dies, then I want the five to take it. If two of them die, I want the four to take it, because they constitute an identifiable class fitting all the prerequisites of what constitutes a class as laid down in 1916 in Haygood versus Haygood. We'll read some very pertinent language. To decide the all-important question of whether this is a class gift or not, if it is a class gift, then the Court of Appeals opinion must be affirmed. And the trial court must be affirmed if it is a class gift. The third issue in this case is whether the phrase or word "and to the survivor or survivors of them," whether the word "and" used in that context creates such an ambiguity as would require extraneous evidence to determine what the testatrix really meant.
Neither party pled ambiguity.
Neither party pleaded ambiguity. Let me, Justice Gonzalez, insert this just a moment. I have been in this court on one occasion where both of us pleaded no ambiguity, and the court said we were both wrong and neither one of us heard it. And sent it back for a new trial.
How easy will it be for you to find evidence of
who
this
was
in 1952 or
is that? 1950, early 1950s, when the will was written. The dead man statute has, what I used to refer to the dead man statute, Justice Phillips, has been loosened up to the extent that I can, I have plenty of evidence based on that if it were to suffer, if we were to suffer a remand in this case. I think that the dead man statute has undergone a great overhauling, and I don't know whether it's good or bad, but in this case it's going to be good if we were to have a remand. Whether the phrase or word "and" to the survivor or survivors makes any difference or creates any ambiguity that sends both parties back to the trial court. Now those, to me, those are the three issues.
What would you try?
What her intentions were, I don't think that. I really don't see that as a viable alternative. I see it as a possible alternative, but we would try. What was her intention? Bring us in some extraneous evidence to let us know if there's any ambiguity.
Would the problem be contradictory?
I beg your pardon?
The more likely to be contradictory.
Yes, sir. These are the food for thought that we've got. I take the position that there is a great distinction between Parker versus Henderson, the case that we just mentioned and written by this court. The distinction in Parker versus Henderson as compared to ours is, it can describe it in no other way other than glaring. And therefore, there is no, the two do not reach opposite conclusions. Rereading the opinion in Parker versus Henderson, you can see at a glance that that bequest was made to A, I give Blackacre. To B, I give Whiteacre. And to C, I give Grayacre. And specific provisions given. And then it said, these are my three boys. And the opinion in Parker versus Henderson said, that was not a class gift. I agree. That's the reason I say Parker versus Henderson affords no real basis of conflict of decision. Because in that case, although this court said there is no class gift, we have the distinction of giving specific pieces of property to a specific person. And I'm the first one to say, had this testatrix in this case said to Herman, I give Blackacre, I wouldn't be here. I think that is a valid, glaring, all-powerful distinction between the Parker case and this case. But that's not all of the distinction. I think we must talk about Parker versus Henderson. And that is not the only distinction. They had specific gifts to specific persons in that case, but there is another distinction that's almost as important, and that is, in our case, in this case today, we have the phrase at the survivors, of them at the time of my death. That language is not in Parker versus Henderson. And in writing the opinion, this important care was taken when she said, or when the testatrix in that case said, the children, surviving children of our marriage, you will recall how you dealt with that phrase. You said the surviving children of the marriage at the time of the writing of the will. Those three were surviving at the time of the writing of the will. And so that is almost equally as an important of a distinction as the other part concerning specific gifts. Because in this case, this testator says the surviving survivors at the time of my death. All right.
Let me ask you this. You have not made this argument yet, and maybe I'm overemphasizing grammar. but the six children are named, and then, and to the survivor or survivors of them. Well, Nadine and her deceased brother may be a survivor of Herman, but they are not survivors of the other five of Herman's brothers and sisters. So I'm wondering if there is any special importance to be placed upon the word survivors of them in construction of this will.
Justice Kilgarland, I believe that you're touching upon the final point that I am going to, that I have listed as the reason why this court cannot go along with petitioner's position. And I'll jump into it right at this point. The San Antonio court may be an error, but they drew the same conclusion in 1985 as I do in regard to what is meant by survivor. I found this case after I had written a brief, and I told the marshal when I used to be here I would hand to the clerk those citations that are not in my brief that I'm going to talk about. I didn't know whether that was right or wrong, but she has the list for the court. I gave it to her. I gave a copy to my opponent, Mr. Green. And the San Antonio, let's deal with that word survivors just a moment. With this premise, in order to go along with petitioner's position in this case, the word survivors and heirs must mean one and the same thing. No, I can improve on that some. The word survivors and children must mean one and the same thing. And there's where we get into trouble. Because when you take the word survivors of them out of a description describing a class, you lose what is meant by survivor. Now you say, I don't understand what you mean, counsel, but let me illustrate. What is a survivor? If we're not talking about a survivor of a class, what is the legal definition of survivor? There is none that I can find in Texas, except as quoted by the San Antonio Court of Appeal. I have such a hard time striking the word civil, Court of Civil Appeal. But the San Antonio Court of Appeal said that in Gregg versus Jones, said that appellant urges a construction of this as would make survivors and heirs mean the same thing, and they are not the same thing. I'm going to illustrate a little further why we cannot go along with the petitioner's position in this case. Who are the survivors? How did you know who the survivors are? And if we were to put the question, let's say some what ifs. What if Herman died and left a wife? Would she be a survivor? Or would limit it to children, lineal descendants? Who is a survivor? There is no definition, legal definition of the word survivor unless you name one or more than one person and put them in a class and talk about the survivor of them. But as far as saying a survivor is an heir or something similar to that, I know of no Texas cases that say that, and that's the trouble we would get into if we said the six children are not a class. And incidentally, I see nothing, there's no law that prohibits naming the six children. That does not take them out of a class. You can have I leave this to my six children, that forms a class. Saying I leave this to my six children, A, B, C, D, E, and F, does not take them out of that class gift. So naming them does not remove that.
Excuse me for interrupting.
No
are
problem.
You saying that a wife is not a survivor?
No, I suppose. No, in this case, she didn't survive. But I'm trying
to understand that ordinary case. Joe Blow, you meet the obituaries, every day. Joe Blow, survived by his spouse and children.
She's a survivor, of course, but not in what, if we're talking about titles to estates, when we talk about survivors, Justice Gonzalez, I don't know how you would say it. If we had a first cousin, that would be a survivor. If we had brothers and sisters, and this illustrates, let me talk about this just a moment. Let's suppose survivors of them, survivors of the class that you mentioned a while ago. Let's say this daughter that brought this lawsuit is a survivor of the other five brothers. Then that means that we've got to redivide. Does she get share and share alike with the other five surviving brothers and sisters? See, this is the trouble that we would get into if we accord credence to petitioner's position. Does the survivors all take equally? If there are 25 survivors, do all of those share equally with five brothers and sisters?
Doesn't that chart of descent and distribution come into play when you're in that?
In this case, I don't know whether the laws of descent and distribution...
But if you decided that survivors meant heirs, then you could refer to that.
Yes, very well. The San Antonio court says specifically that they urge an adoption of the word survivor as being the same thing as heirs.
And but we're all survivors, and everyone who has predeceased us, whether they were relatives or not.
And that compounds the problem. How do you decide who are the survivors that are going to take and who don't? Do we go by heirs? Or is the wife, if the wife survives, do we cut her out saying that she's not included in the word survivors?
Or would you go to separate community property?
In that case, this would be property given by will and descent and distribution. And would be governed by those rules. But in determining, in other words, there could be a cause of action if that is what this testatrix meant, which from the four corners, I think not. Then you'd have to have a declaratory judgment. Who are the survivors? Am I, as a wife, the survivor of Herman, a deceased son that predeceased his mother? Is that what she meant to do? That I would, since I survived him, I get part of it? And if so, how much of the other five children's part do I get? It says share and share alike. You said, Counsel, why do you bring up this argument? The argument is brought up to show the intention of the testatrix from the four corners of the instrument when she said, and to the survivor, survivors or survivors of them, I'm here to tell you that I wish you hadn't used the word and. I don't believe the word and has any control when we look at the Parker versus Henderson, Perry versus Henshaw, and the Haygood case. The word and is not going to make the decision in this case. It's not going to change. The inevitable happens. I found the case. Cited in the little extra sheet of paper that I've given. Would you believe that says in certain instances, and means or, and or means and. If it's meant to be that way, to give it full meaning to the intention of the testator or testatrix. And it's a Atlantic second case. And I've cited Jackson versus Schubert. But the reasoning of the court is so attractive that says if you've got the words and or in there, and the intention of the testatrix, how much, I forgot the green light, how much warrant does that give?
5 minutes when it comes on.
Pardon? 5 minutes?
He doesn't have 5 minutes left now.
About four now.
All right. Well, I got too wrapped up, didn't I? I didn't even notice the green light. But at any rate, to give meaning to a whole will, there are instances when and or can be used interchangeably. And I think this is one of those shining examples.
Counsel, you and I both may be the only two in this courtroom old enough to remember diagramming sentences. But
yes, sir.
If you diagram this one, doesn't them apply to the the children that remained?
In my opinion, what I recall about diagramming sons is where you put it up on stilts and things and put your phrases up there. Gosh, it's been many years since I remember that, but you're 100% right. That's the way I recall it. I wanted to visit with you a little bit about Justice Camel's opinion in Perry versus Henshaw, and in which he says naming these people does not create a clash gift. In that case, it says, I give to so-and-so one half. To other one, I give to the surviving brothers and sisters of my husband and me as follows. To A, I give one half. To the surviving brothers and sisters of my husband, I give the other one half. That's essentially what it said. And Justice Campbell said, in that opinion, that did not create a clash gift. And yet he reached the same result because Vera Perry, as I recall her name, was the only one of the survivors of the second group. And he said it did not create a clash gift. But let me call your attention to the fact that there are two phrases. And what I think he meant to say was the first phrase did not create a clash gift. The second one did. And that's exactly what happened. So there is no difference in the holding of Parker versus Henderson as to the result I'm talking about, and as compared to this Court of Appeals holding in this case, they're not opposite one another. In fact, they had to adopt the language in Parker versus Henderson or strike it down. They didn't have that authority. So the careful word survivor, the word survivors means something to me in making my summation to this court. Why? Because you said it did. That's why it's important. You mentioned survivors. That's not my language, that's your language.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Tim. Thank you. I thought the red light was coming on. I'm sorry.
You still have another minute.
Oh, no, that's it. Thank you.
Mr. Green?
Yes, sir.
Justice Gonzalez asked Mr. Bowers if he hadn't heard of the expression, when a person died, he is survived by his wife, or something like that. So I'm going to ask you, have you heard the expression, let's say six people go up in an airplane, and the plane crashes, and there are five survivors. Have you heard that expression?
Yes, Your Honor, I have.
Now, who would the five survivors be in reference to? Would it be in reference to the six people who went up in the airplane initially?
No, sir. I believe it would be for those that died, the wife would be a survivor if you had a person had a wife or a husband, a spouse, or the children. I don't believe it would refer to collateral kindred so far off as a 15th cousin or something like that. We read obituaries daily. In fact, I appreciate the comments that Mr. Bowers made concerning my deceased partner. But as we read his obituary, he was survived by his wife, Nina, and three sons. And they were named. I have no more problem with that than Mr. Bowers seemed to have with transposing. We phrased it, change and or if it meets what you want to do. So I think we can just as easily do that, even though he says there is an opinion from the appeals court in San Antonio that says you're not allowed to do that. I believe that case was an NRE, and of course I don't know, haven't read the case. I would like to respond just briefly to about the three questions that Mr. Bowers posed to us. The first one, can a testator write a will that violates the anti-lapse statute? I think certainly you can. She could have done that very easily in this case by using different words and accomplished the very thing he seems to indicate that we want to do away with. All she would have had to have said was, I have six children. If any of them are deceased at the time I die, they predeceased me. Then no one representing that child will get anything. could very easily have said, the six children that I have, they must survive in order to take anything under my will. Maybe some more artful words that we use sometimes. But I like to use these words that she used here because, first, the will was done in 1952. And I'm not so sure but what she was thinking other thing. The will was prepared in 54. The grandson had died in 52. And that grandson was a survivor of someone. It was the someone was her son, Herman. So I think at that time she had in mind that there might be survivors. And she very easily could have said to such of my children who are living at the time of my death. It would have been very easy to say it that way. To such of my children who are living at the time of my death. And that's the construction.
Excuse me, did any of the children pre-decease her? You said Herman did.
Herman did, yes. Herman died in 1960. Herman died in 1961.
Okay.
He had a child named Leon who died in 1962.
Leon.
Yes,
ma'am.
So, there's no question.
How could Leon possibly be a survivor under your definition since he predeceased?
I'm not so sure that he could. But he was if we substitute the word heir.
Well, let's go back to the obituary.
All right.
You have Natty dying, and they print Natty's obituary, and Leon's dead all right. They wouldn't say Natty was survived by Leon, would they?
No. I wouldn't think of it that way. Then his second question, I believe, was whether the Parker case forecloses the right to devise property to children only. We don't contend that, never have contended that, and I think anybody that would make such a contention would be foolish. That would be depriving someone of the right to devise their property in the manner that they desire. So I don't read the Parker case that way, nor I don't see how anyone could seriously contend that case would do so. And then his third question was, does the word "and" create an ambiguity? And no, ma'am, we didn't ever take the position that there was anything ambiguous about this will at all. Both sides moved for summary judgment, both sides thinking they were correct in it. I hadn't thought that it could be ambiguous. To me is just an ordinary common English word that we use all the time. And when you said "and," to me, as I've argued previously, it had to include "and to such of them," if they're deceased, "and to their survivors." We've got to go back to the "of them," and we've got to use all of those words. We can't disregard one. And I couldn't agree with Mr. Bowers in wanting to substitute "or" for "and," because that's the trap I think the Court of Appeals fell into. And I think it's wrong. I don't agree with his contention that the Parker case would be absolutely 100% controlling of this case if Mrs. Moore had said, "Herman gets this tract, Black Acre, and the rest of the children get a different tract." I don't really think that the law should be that if you are devised a particular tract of land, then in no cases can the anti-lapse statute prevail. Because that construction would be if a cousin by the name of Herman or Johnny dies, but he got devised a particular tract of land, then he's deceased, his heirs or his children or someone is going to get his tract, and I can't see that case standing for that proposition at all. In conclusion, I would say that the word "and" is important.
it has strong bearing on this case. The words "of them" have to refer back to in sentence structure to all six of the children.
An irrelevant question. Perhaps how old was Maddie when she died?
I really don't know.
She had a grandson and had children who predeceased her about 24 years.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Kathleen.